The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I wanted to just start by checking in with you about what you noticed when I asked you to connect with stillness. Anybody willing to share what you noticed? Yeah, you could use the mic. It's on the side. Is the light green?
No, it's on.
Okay.
I find the physical stillness to be very easy. It's the mental stillness that's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice, partly what I'm, it's true, the mind goes all over the place, but what I was pointing to was just whether you might be able to notice a connection between the body and mind. That's kind of where I'm going today. So if you noticed any inclination to move at all.
I do notice that when I'm aware, I can like have an itch and just decide to not scratch.
Yes, yeah, that's the kind of thing I'm talking
right.
about, right?
Yeah, if I have my attention in the right place, that's very easy and very interesting.
Uh-huh, yes.
So
yeah, and so what that points to, I mean, you feel an itch. You're sitting there quietly and you feel an itch, and you notice kind of there's an inclination to scratch the itch. But when the mind does get settled, it's relatively easy for you to say, okay, well, I'm just going to observe that itch instead of moving. But that impulse to move or that urge to move is kind of the place that I'm interested in exploring today. So that's why I did the little exercise. So thank you. I'm curious, did anybody... yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I learned something from the experience. Prior to that, while I was meditating, I'm working on a project in my house, and I kept going to the details, you know. And so I brought in something that I've learned from you, which is to say, "May the mind relax." So I kept doing that, and it was effective. You know, we all struggle with this, right? It was effective for a while. But when you did the exercise or the suggestion that you pay attention to stillness, I didn't have any struggles with that. It was with ease. What I found was it deepened my ability to relax the mind. And I'm putting that together with something I learned this weekend. I went to a conference with Jack Kornfield and Dan Siegel up in San Francisco. And Dan Siegel was saying, you know, when we're meditating, we pay a lot of attention to the thoughts that we're trying to get back to just being in the present. He says, but we don't pay enough attention to what's going on in the body. And so when you did this suggestion, it all kind of came together, which mm-hmm. is, yeah, if you pay attention to the urges of the body in the moment, that's another way of relaxing the mind
yes.
and the body.
It can be. Yeah, yeah, that's great. And actually, another thing this points to is I find for myself, and this is another theme that I'll talk about a little bit, is that, you know, if you connect with the intention of stillness or just like connect with that sense of, you know, stilling the body, that has an impact on the mind. You know, the connecting with that movement to just be still in the body, you can sometimes take refuge in that if the mind is going nuts. It's just like, okay, yep, the mind is going nuts, but I'm just going to sit here in a still way. And somehow that intention towards stillness of the body has an impact that reverberates on the mind. And so that actually, now we've pointed to both sides of the equation that I want to talk about today, so I'll move into that. And that is, I'd like to start by just exploring, you know, most of us are familiar with the fact that there is a connection with the mind and the body. I mean, we know this. We feel a strong emotion and we feel, you know, if we feel frustration, there can be tightness and tension in our body that results from that mental experience of frustration. So there's the mind that impacts the body in that way. And also, we also know that the inner workings of our mind impact our behavior. That if we get angry, that we tend to behave in an angry way. So we are very familiar with that direction, actually, of the connection, that the mind impacts the body. And that interrelationship between the mind and the body does go both ways, as we just pointed to, with the connecting to the stillness of the body, that can have an impact on the mind. So this interrelationship between the mind and the body is a two-way street, and we can use that to help us in our practice. So I just want to offer one example about the relationship between the body and the mind that's a little surprising if you haven't explored it or experimented with it before. And this is something that Paul Ekman and Richard Davidson. Paul Ekman is a researcher on emotions, and Richard Davidson is a researcher on a lot about how meditation and mindfulness impacts our brain. And in doing some of the research around emotions and the brain, they discovered that when they asked people to physically put a smile on their face, it made the mind, the brain, go into patterns typical of happiness. So this is a very potent thing. You know, we don't tend to trust this direction of the link as much. You know, we feel like, okay, yep, I'm feeling angry. Of course it makes sense that I express my anger. If we feel anger and we put a smile on our face to see if we can move into a little bit more calmness or happiness, we feel like I'm not being true to myself, or, you know, it's somehow being counter to what's actually going on. And so we don't tend to trust that direction of the link as much. So I'm going to talk about both sides of this. So to point to the place, actually, the place where the quality of mind, the factor of mind that is the link in terms of the Buddhist understanding, the Buddhist psychology, it is a factor called intention. Intention, in this technical term, in the way that Buddhist psychology uses it, it's a kind of a subtle shift of mind that precedes any action that we do, whether it's an action of body, an action of speech, or even an action of mind. So essentially, we can know we're going to move before we move, which I hope that guided meditation kind of pointed you to a little bit. We can know we're going to speak before we speak. And we can even know we're going to think before we think. Kind of a pre-verbal way, we can sense a thought coming. We can know an emotion is coming before the emotion actually appears. That's a very subtle form of this seeing, of this intention. So in and of itself, this quality of intention, this factor of intention, which actually happens all the time. I mean, even as I move my hand like that, there's an intention every split second for me to keep moving my hand. So intention is a very, very subtle quality of mind. It's actually most easy for us to connect into with major shifts of posture. So, you know, you can, or major actions. So you can know, you know, if you're sitting in silence, it can be highlighted, oh, there's an itch, and kind of the urge to scratch. That's a kind of an easy one to see. Or if you're changing postures, going from sitting to standing or standing to walking, you can start to see this impulse to act before you act. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. So in and of itself, this intention, this impulse to do, the intention itself is neutral. It's just the impulse to act. But it is always accompanied by what we can call a motivation, the reason why we are going to act. And that reason can be varied. We might be motivated out of anger or frustration. We might be motivated out of excitement. We might be motivated out of agitation. Or we might be motivated out of confusion. Or we might be motivated out of kindness, compassion, generosity, balance of mind. So in and of itself, intention is neutral. And it can be felt in different ways. I mean, it can be experienced in different ways. It might be experienced as just a kind of an energetic impulse, kind of almost a feeling, a kinesthetic feeling of the action that you're going to do before it happens. So right now, some of you may get the sense of this. Think about standing up. Sometimes that produces a kind of a rush of feeling through the body, as if the body is preparing to stand up. So sometimes the intention can be felt that way, as a kind of an energetic move, an energetic pulse through the body. Sometimes it can be felt or known as a thought in the mind, something along the lines of, time to get up now. Just the mind saying those words. So it can be felt in different ways, so there's no one way that it's felt. And when we start to get familiar with that moment of we're about to do something, we can begin to connect with the motivation that accompanies it. And in connecting to that motivation, we have a chance to choose how we act. So the point of connecting with knowing something is about to happen before it happens is to be able to connect us to the motivation that accompanies it and decide, is this a motivation that I wish to act out of? And I'll talk more about that in just a moment. So intention basically is kind of the link, the point that mind and body come together in Buddhist psychology. And it is, even if it's not the only, technically the only place where mind and body come together, it's a very powerful one to understand. And we can understand it through our mindfulness, through our meditative practice. So just a simple example of how intention works as a kind of a bridge between the mind and body. So for example, we decide we're going to sit down and do a project at the computer. Many, many mental activities have gone into that decision. Lots of thoughts, lots of intentions, lots of planning have gone into that choice, that decision. I'm going to go to work at the computer. And then from that, there forms the intention to actually go and sit, perhaps, in front of the computer or stand in front of the computer, depending on what your proclivities are. So there you are, sitting in front of the computer, working away, and you've been sitting there working away for a couple hours, and thirst arises. So this is a bodily thing. So what we had before was kind of intention, decisions, mental activity, creating an intention which led us to do something with the body. So the mind impacted the body, and we went and sat down. And now we're sitting down, we're doing this stuff, and the body is doing its thing. It's not having water, it's getting thirsty. Thirst arises, the body gets thirsty, is the physical aspect of the body. And with that thirst arising, the mind wants to do something about it. It wants to go get a drink. And so there's the impulse or the urge to get up and go get a drink of water. So again, we had the body, here we had the body creating an impulse in the mind. So the body got thirsty. This created a wish, a desire to get some water. And that wish or that desire to get some water conditioned the impulse to get up and get the water. So the body impacted the mind. The thirst created the wish. And then we have the wish creating the intention. And then the intention to get the water prompts us to get up and go get the water. So it's a two-way street. Body impacts mind, mind impacts body, body impacts mind, in a never-ending flow of cause and effect. So this is a very simple example. You know, in this case, you know, the impulse to get up to get a drink is, you know, it's a wholesome one. You know, we need to maintain the health of our bodies. You could have that same action, the same physical action, if you took a movie, no difference of what the body does, but perhaps after a couple of hours of sitting at the computer, you've hit a wall of some kind. You know, you've hit some kind of a frustrating thing or an email that you're having trouble responding to, and frustration is arising, and you're getting tense and agitated in the mind. And this conditions then the impulse to get up and leave the computer. So the same sequence of physical events conditioned by different mental experience. So this place of looking at the intention and the motivation accompanying that intention, the Buddha actually pointed to that as kind of the key to our happiness. Without intention, the mind and the body, the action wouldn't happen. So the mind motivates. And that intention which motivates is really important to recognize. This is from the Dhammapada. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. So in those verses, those are the very first two verses of the Dhammapada, in those verses the Buddha is pointing to the motivation that accompanies our intention to act and says, this is crucial. This is what will lead either to our happiness or to our suffering. It's not the action itself. You know, kind of in that example I gave of the computer, you know, the same action outwardly motivated by different internal mind states. The experience internally is different. One, there's not much suffering. There's a little bit perhaps of suffering or discomfort around the thirst. And the other, there's a lot of agitation, a lot of internal turmoil. So the Buddha pointed this to this moment of knowing what's about to happen and the motivation that accompanies it as a key to our freedom and our happiness. So we have the possibility in that moment of seeing what's about to happen and seeing perhaps the motivation along with it. We may have the opportunity to choose how to act or how not to act. This is one of the key benefits of being mindful. When we're mindful and aware in the present moment, we have the opportunity to see our motivations, to see the reasons why we are getting ready to do something. the only place we have any kind of ability to actually make a choice is in the present moment. All of the choices we've made in the past have already been made. We can't go back and change them, no matter how much we want to. So much of our minds actually go back trying to figure out, how can I change that? How can I change the past? We do that in our minds. We somehow think, somehow if we think about it enough, we'll be able to rearrange the past. No matter how much we think about and plan for the future, we can't make our choices in the future now. We never know how we're going to be when we get there. I've seen so many times in my own life thinking, you know, my mind tends to be a planning. It goes out into the future and creates all the possible scenarios that might happen and thinks about, okay, in that situation, that's what I'll do. And in that situation, that's what I'll do. And in that situation, that's how I'll respond. And what I've seen in looking at that planning and in watching what happens if, in fact, one of those scenarios actually happens, which most of the time it doesn't, so I'm left with some scenario I hadn't anticipated and needing to respond in the moment. If one of those scenarios does happen, most of the time what I've seen is that there are other things going on that I had no way of anticipating that are impacting me in the present moment, and I cannot choose the thing that I had planned to do. So the vast majority of the time, thinking about how we're going to choose in the future doesn't work very well for us. But being present and noticing this moment, how can I choose now? That is very powerful. It's the only place we can do anything, the present moment. So bringing mindfulness and attention to this moment is what charts our course. We can step forward into the next moment by making a skillful choice now, if we can see this moment. Now, it's really helpful, it's important in this kind of choosing. You know, we might see something come up. We might see a motivation of frustration arise and realize, okay, well, there's some frustration there. Maybe I should hold off on speaking right now. If that holding off on speaking is done out of a sense of compassion for yourself, out of compassion for the other person, or a sense of kindness, that's great. We can also be motivated to refrain from doing something out of aversion, of a sense that, oh, I'm bad for having that frustration. I shouldn't speak. A good Buddhist wouldn't speak right now. That being a kind of an aversive way to not act. That's not so helpful. So, you know, it's a kind of a tricky thing in a way. You know, we need to just be aware of our motivations for our choices. So one of the great places to practice with this is in the area of speech. So many times I think everybody probably has had the experience of wishing they hadn't said something they'd said. And so bringing this kind of awareness to our speech can help us to recognize the motivations behind our speech. Actually, most of the time we are speaking, kind of just blurting things out without even really knowing what we're going to say before we say it a lot of the time. And much less do we even think, do we take a chance to reflect on how what we're going to say is going to impact the other person or what the consequences are of speaking. So this paying attention to speak can be really challenging. A very simple exercise around this is to pause before you speak, if you can do that. If you can pause before you speak, you've caught the intention to speak. It's kind of that impulse to speak has come up, and you've caught it. It's like, oh, just wait a second. pause, just for a split second. In that split second, you will probably know what you're about to say. You'll have a sense of that. And you may also see the motivation or the reason why you're going to say it. Is it a motivation of connection, of communication? Is it a motivation of frustration or anger? Is it a motivation of wanting something, of self-aggrandizement, of proving that you know something, of how smart you are? There's lots of reasons why we might speak. So this reflection, you know, actually this reflection can be kind of eye-opening. It can be humbling, very humbling. to begin to see why we speak. So this isn't meant to be an exercise in self-flagellation around seeing these reasons. It's really about making these things conscious. When they become conscious, we have the opportunity to choose something about them. I'd much rather know that I've got that impulse than not know and just blindly act out of it. Our habits and patterns, the ways that we habitually respond in the world, when we're not mindful, it's those habits and patterns that are making our choices for us. Those choices are being made even if we don't consciously see those choices. So in the process of beginning to witness our mind making choices, at first we get to see it making unskillful choices because our habits and patterns are strong. So we get to watch it. Think, oh, there's something, I shouldn't say that, and say it anyway. Partly the kind of the momentum behind our habits is strong. We've been practicing these habits kind of for a long time. We've been practicing habits of wanting, habits of wanting to get rid of, habits of wanting to look good, habits of wanting to have our own way. We've been practicing those for a long time. And so to think that beginning to be mindful will stop the momentum of those habits cold is a little unrealistic. What we get to do is to watch those habits and patterns unfold. Sometimes we can watch them unfold mentally. I mean, the benefit of the mindfulness a lot is that in seeing these habits and patterns begin to come up, with the mindfulness, often we can recognize, okay, I'm in a state that's not so good to be acting out of right now, so I'm just going to just hang out with this feeling. So we've seen the unwholesome experience arise, the pattern or habit that's heading us towards some unskillful action. And we recognize that, okay, with mindfulness, I can just hang out with this feeling. That's a different way of being with that feeling than acting out of it. And it is like what happens when we do that. It's like the momentum of our habits and patterns. When we're not aware of them, when we're not aware of those habits and patterns and we're just kind of following those habits and patterns, it's as if there's, you know, gears of the habit and pattern that are reinforcing themselves and keeping the momentum of those habits going when we're not aware. And what happens when we bring our mindfulness to our experience is kind of like the gears disengage. The momentum is still there, so the gears are still spinning, so that pattern is still there, but it's no longer given more energy. So if you have a disengaged gear, eventually it stops. It's like putting a car into neutral. The car's not going to stop immediately, but it will come to a stop. So that's what happens as we begin to notice these moments. Choose to simply be mindful. The choice to be mindful is actually one of the most powerful choices that we can make. So noticing that we're choosing to be mindful, actually, we can rejoice in that choice, that that's a wholesome choice, even though we may still be feeling and seeing these patterns unfold. So I'd like to go back for a moment. I've been talking a lot about looking at the choices, the motivation, and seeing if we can, in seeing that, choose perhaps to just be mindful instead of acting on a choice. I'd like to talk a little bit about the other direction now. I've been talking about how the mind influences our action. Now I'd like to talk about how our bodies can impact our minds, going back to that direction. So as I said before, we often don't trust this direction. If we're feeling impatient, it somehow feels false to act as though we're patient. So what I'm proposing here is that there is a way of engaging with the body that can have a rebound effect on our minds. So if we are feeling something like impatience, it's a teaching around not repressing the feeling. So for instance, the impatience arises and you notice the impatience and notice how it's impacting or leaking out into your behavior. I had this happen to me. I told this story last week, but I don't think I told it in this group. So I was shopping. I was doing some shopping at a drugstore and I felt the impatience inside of me. And I noticed that it was leaking out into my behavior. The way that I was taking things off the shelf, there was a kind of a harshness to the action, and then kind of throwing them into the basket. So I noticed that the impatience was leaking out into my behavior. And I had been exploring this teaching around body impacting mind. And so I decided to say, okay, I'm going to acknowledge this impatience. So not trying to put patience into the mind. This is a key for this kind of a practice. Not trying to put patience into the mind. But instead, seeing if I could act as though I were patient. Clearly acknowledging that impatience was there. So it's kind of like acknowledging the impatience and seeing, can I behave in a way that doesn't have this impatience leak out into my actions? Essentially what this is an intention of behaving patiently, even though the impatience is present. So it's bringing in the intention towards an action of patience, which brings in a little bit of that mental movement towards patience, inclining the mind in that direction. And I found the combination of not having the mental experience leak out into the behavior, plus that, well, the non-repression of the mental state itself, and the kind of intention towards behaving with that wholesome quality of patience. In this particular example, when I was in the drugstore shopping, I noticed probably within 2 minutes, my mind state had radically altered. And I was feeling calm and patient. So this is a very powerful tool for us in exploring our minds and bodies. So behaving peacefully actually cultivates peace. If you are not repressing something, or if you are not behaving peacefully in order to deceive someone, it needs to come out of this genuine wish to cultivate the quality of peace, of truthfulness, of kindness, of compassion. But it can be very powerful. So I've probably talked for long enough. We've got still quite a bit of time for sharing or questions or comments or thoughts. Yeah.
One thing I was thinking about just now, listening to you talk about patience and impatience. I've had that experience of finding that energy in me and deciding I don't really want that energy, to act as if that's not there and to watch it dissipate. But patience and impatience is sort of an easy one. It's like anger or other sort of yucky emotions that come up. It's not as easy to mindfully choose to act as though those emotions aren't happening.
Well, that's true. That's true. And all I can say is that just, you know, first of all, the mindfulness, I mean, what I was saying before is just the mindfulness, the intention towards mindfulness is probably our best first tool to use. And, you know, playing with a little bit in areas perhaps, you know, one way to play with this is not perhaps in an area of a very strong emotion, but, you know, these patterns and habits that we have. I mean, I have a very strong, you know, have had a very strong pattern towards anger. I practiced a lot of anger in my life. And, you know, the moments when it gets really strong, it's harder to not have it perhaps leak out into the face, or I mean, even if you're not acting, you know, or just into the vibe, you know, just into the vibe of your body, you know, just somehow a little tension in the body, especially if you're with somebody who knows you really well, you know, they know, even if you're not acting, they know. But these patterns and habits that we have manifest also in smaller ways, you know, so for me, you know, irritation, annoyance, that kind of thing. So beginning to see if you can notice the smaller versions and work with those first. And that will give you some of the strength. Actually, I find this to be really helpful in all forms of mindfulness. You know, if you find yourself caught a lot in a particular pattern, where you can't be mindful of it because it's so overwhelming, really helpful to notice those smaller ones and really see if you can bring the attention to the inklings towards that pattern. It builds the strength so that we can begin to meet the more difficult ones. And so practicing with the less difficult ones first. Thank you for the question. Oh, Victor.
Just a comment that sort of brings home how bodies can affect emotion. I was on some medication that made, it turns out, the body very agitated. And on the warning it says it could cause emotional this and that or that, you know, whatever. And I had to take it some subsequent weeks. And the first week I took it, and it wears off, but the first week I took it, I was just the most incredibly bad mood, just quick in temper, and just it was just awful to be with. And pretty observant, seeing this, it's like I've become a monster. This is awful. The second week, I noticed that before any emotions happened, there was just an incredible amount of body sensations that if I just tuned into the body sensations, the emotions didn't emerge that way. I could just be with the body, and it was uncomfortable, but it didn't migrate into anything else. And it was really interesting just to see that causal relationship. Yes. Without being mindful, you react in a certain way, and you know, it's not always skillful.
That's a great example. Thank you for bringing that up. It's so true. And in fact, you know, this is a great one for women about my age. You know, I get hot flashes, and it's a release of adrenaline into the body. And when I first started having them, it's like my whole body was just like, "What's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong?" And I, you know, without being mindful, I would find something wrong in the environment to be agitated about. But then I began to realize, oh, you know, this is just this chemical. It's just like chemical flooding into the body. This can be also really important for us to know, again, along the lines of these habits. I mean, things like drugs can do this to us. Just simple, you know, being in a scenario, a situation, can bring up some tension, and then we can react to that tension. Also, another important thing to recognize is that with these habits and patterns that we have of mental, our favorite flavor of suffering, we all have our favorite flavor of suffering, that becomes a habit not only of mind, but of body, because there's such a tight connection between mind and body. And so, you know, if you have a habit of frustration, the tension and tightness of the body around that can also become a habit. And I found in meditation, the place where I really clearly saw this happen to me, it was in meditation. I was on a long retreat, and I felt this band of pressure around my head, and kind of this, I was making a face. And it felt like, the body felt like, oh yeah, this is making too much effort. I had a very strong habit of making a lot of effort in my meditation practice. But when I looked at the mind, it was not making too much effort. But the body was in that pattern. It's almost like the habit of body had arisen before the habit of mind. And if I hadn't noticed it, it was almost like, yeah, okay, time to make some effort here. It's kind of like the body was gearing up to do this thing. It's when I noticed that, it's like, oh, I don't have to do that. So the body had a habit, and we can notice that around patterns of emotions as well. You know, we can have a habit of frustration or a habit of anger that is kind of entrenched in our bodies. And those patterns can arise even though the mental pattern is not present. And if you can be aware of that, what I found happening is, oh yeah, there's this feeling in the body. Scan the environment to find something that proves that this feeling is appropriate. And you can almost always find something when you look for it. You know, oh, I'm angry. What am I angry about? If you don't find something in the environment, you can create something in your mind. So this being mindful of the body and how it can impact the mind, that can also be very powerful for us. So thank you for bringing that up.
I'm I can recall some 60 years ago or so, my mother would tell me to put a smile on my face, much as the researchers' work suggests now. That's my quick and hopefully not too deadly comment. My question is more one about where in Buddhist cosmology or view of the world, where does the brain belong? Does it belong to body or mind or both? And the reason I ask that is that I'm having trouble with the separation that your talk seems to be suggesting between body and mind, as if they need linkages, but they're not already together.
In some ways, what I'm pointing to is the fact that they are linked, that there's strong interconnection between them. I'm not sure what, I think for a long time, the brain wasn't even mentioned, apparently, in the suttas. I mean, they talked about the mind residing here. So, I'm not sure, what Buddhist psychology has to say about the brain. And I'm not sure partly what I think is important in our experience, because, everything that we're talking about here comes back to our experience. And what is important in our experience is to begin to recognize what the distinction is between what our mind is doing and what our body is doing. Because there is a difference. There is a difference between, and whether or not that mind is simply physical activity of neurons firing in the brain, if all of mental activity ultimately comes back to physical activity, that's not quite so relevant for the experience, because we can't feel neurons firing in the brain. At least I can't feel that. But I can know anger as a mental experience and know that it impacts the body in terms of feelings of pressure and heat. And there's a difference between the pressure and heat and the mental experience of the anger. And that's more what I'm pointing to. And that it's very helpful to begin to notice what is our mind contributing to, and how is our mind contributing to our experience? And what's the actual physical experience? There's so much in the way of our physical experience that there's these feedback loops, really tight feedback loops to the mind. And, if we don't notice, like a subtle fear around a particular physical sensation, that can produce a feedback loop that will just make the physical sensation feel more potent for us. If we notice that subtle fear, we see, oh, that's just a small twinge, actually. It's not a huge deal. It's the mind's contribution that is creating this feedback loop. And so to begin to tease them apart, what actually is the actual physical experience here, and how is the mind responding to that? That's mostly what I'm pointing to, is the experience part of it. And whether or not, the brain, is ultimately material, I don't know that there's really an answer to this. There's different people, different, even physicists, so there's some physicists that come down on the line of consciousness is simply a side effect of a particular configuration of matter. And there are others that say, actually, it's an easier explanation of the universe to assume consciousness comes first, and that matter arises out of that. I don't know. That's not my interest. My interest is in suffering. My interest is in how can I see in my own mind, how is the patterns of the mind impacting my body, creating suffering, impacting my mind, creating suffering. So that's where I'm interested in exploring. And from that standpoint, it does feel like we can separate mind and body from the experiential side of it. Does that help?
I find much of what you said today more easily taken in than because of what you just said in response to the question.
Okay, great. Anyone else? Sophia.
I heard some advice on how to help change undesirable behavior, and the expression given was, it's easier to act your way into right thinking than to think your way into right acting.
That's great. I think that's true. I mean, actually, I had a note here. I didn't say it, but something similar. It's like we seem to think somehow we'll change our minds first, and then our behavior will change. It's really hard to change the mind without engaging the body in the process. So that's beautiful. I like that. It's easier to behave your way into right thinking than think your way into right behaving, something like that. Okay, so we have just a couple minutes if there's anything else, but if not, then we can just sit quietly for a couple minutes. Now let's just sit for a couple minutes. I'd like to suggest that you try putting a smile on your face and see what happens. Thank you for your attention.